Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889. From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. It's time for the wearing of the green, as this week we celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Tulane professor Laura Kelly relates the history of the Irish in New Orleans, where they've had a long and storied past. Then, Irish immigrants Pauline and Stephen Patterson share their story of pursuing the American dream here, where they created a home away from home for the Gaelic people at their mid-city pub, Finn McCool's. Nell Boyle is the fourth generation of her family to run Henry's Bar in Uptown New Orleans. Nell takes us back in time to introduce us to her ancestors. We'll eat real Irish breakfast with Scott Gold and wash down some shepherd's pie with a pint or two. We've got the luck of the Irish with us on this week's Louisiana Eats. Tulane professor Laura Kelly's recent book, The Irish in New Orleans, chronicles the story of Irish immigrants in the Crescent City and how they shaped our culture. In honor of St. Patrick's Day, I sat down with Laura to explore this fascinating topic.
So when you did your research, when did the Irish really become an important part of New Orleans?
That's a great question. So the Irish are here from the early French colonial period through the Spanish, but when do you move from being just a group of individuals who happen to be Irish to an ethnic community, a community? And we look at different markers to legitimately say, okay, this is when it's come together. And one of them is, of course, St. Patrick's Day. When do you celebrate a public feast day or saint's day that's associated with a particular group? And the earliest one here in New Orleans that I found documentation for is in March of 1806. So that is, so think about it. We did the whole transfer with Louisiana Purchase in December of 1803. So this is 2.5 years later. And Governor Claiborne is there and various judges and other political people. So very similar to today. What I love about that first one is that they had the 17 traditional toasts. And I keep thinking about all the ones that weren't traditional. But you see, certainly from 1806 forward, you see a lot of this continual public celebration of St. Patrick's Day. It may have happened earlier, but we don't have that many newspapers and it's hard to find evidence for. Other indications are when you build a church, when you have a charitable organization. So all of these things. And certainly charitable organizations happened in the 18-teens and of course, the St. Patrick's is built in 1833. So certainly by 1833, there is a strong Irish community here, but probably I would say earlier, recognizable one.
Everybody who's familiar with New Orleans is familiar with that area that we call the Irish Channel.
Yes.
How did that become the Irish Channel?
Well, first of all, you have to define where is the Irish Channel.
Well, that's true. And you've got a map for us in your book, right?
I do have a map. And it's a map, if you notice, the borders move quite a bit. It's a very fluid map. The Irish Channel is fascinating because New Orleans is known for its neighborhoods, and they're known for their neighborhoods having very distinct boundaries from this street to that street. And the Irish Channel is not that way. It's completely different. And people in the 1930s and 1940s were arguing that it was only Adele Street, just two blocks of Adele Street, which is now, unfortunately, underneath Walmart. On Chapatoulas, and others said it was broader from Jackson to Felicity. And of course, the Historic Landmark Society came in and removed that, and they moved it from, Jackson towards Louisiana. For me, a couple of different things are important to look at. The church, if you want to know where any Irish community is in any city, look where their church is. And St. Alphonsus, located on Constant Street, is the in the heart, to me, of the Irish Channel. And that's in that location between Jackson and Felicity. And it was a church that was built with Irish sweat and Irish pennies and built by those famine immigrants, as was St. John the Baptist and Saints Peter and Paul over on the other side of town. So that gives you an indication of where the Irish community was expanding upon and how you can kind of connect the dots. But the Irish Channel, per se, the first documentation we have of when that term is used, again, public documentation, is in 1893 in a newspaper article. And the fellow being interviewed uses it as if it's been used in common practice for a long time. But he's very vague on the boundaries. He kind of makes it sound like it's from Canal Street upriver. So there is no real definition. I think the Irish Channel is where the Irish heart is.
Well, why did the Irish people settle there?
So the great famine starts. The first potato blight is 1845.
Yeah,
we're still antebellum. And so it's really 1840s into 1850s. And then the Civil War completely halts immigration into the city, which makes New Orleans distinct from places like Boston or New York. Mm-hmm. You know, before the Civil War and at the height of this Irish immigration to the United States, New Orleans had had per capita more Irish than Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago, and was on par with Boston. And there might even be a little debate if we actually had more than Boston. And so New Orleans was really quite the Irish city. And why come here? It's a bustling economic engine. And where did they settle? You settle where work is. You know, we're living in, certainly then, in a walking city. And so where you live, where you work, where you go to church, where you send your children to school, are it's normally all within walking distance. And while the Irish were involved in every type of occupation from a drayman to a doctor to a teacher to a laborer, many of them worked in the port. And that was, you know, New Orleans was the second largest port in America. And so if you're working in the port, you're living near the port. And where's the Irish Channel? I mean, one thing that people do agree upon, it's below Magazine, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not that far from the river.
You have a whole chapter in the book that you refer that you call Irish influence on the New Orleans culinary landscape.
Mm-hmm.
What is the Irish influence?
That is a great question, and I think you have to approach it from a lot of different ways. The Irish are known for actually their absence of food ways. If you look at the Italian, they have very strong food ways. And we associate certain dishes automatically. With the Irish, what do you associate with them? Potatoes. And more potatoes.
But we don't really have any famous New Orleans potato dishes, do we?
No, we don't. And there aren't any more famous, you know, potato dishes, to be fair, to the Irish. And when I say an absence of food ways, the reason for their mass migration to the United States was the failure of one crop. It was the potato crop. And then you have to stop and ask yourself, how does the failure of one crop affect mass migration? Food is still being grown in Ireland. Mm. Well, it affects it when 60% of your population is eating solely or mainly just potatoes. How did they eat them? Two main ways, gruel or baked potato. And this was without butter and salt or pepper or anything. And so you have a devastation of a crop. You come to America and your association with food is famine. You know, your main one food source is famine. And when you study the Irish, what's one of the first things they do when they come to America? They become everybody's cooks. And I think one of the reasons they become their cooks is because they're like, teach me what you want. Uh-huh. You know, they're kind of a tabula rasa. They're a blank slate. And I think in the city, what you see are individual Irish people who influence food in their own way, but not necessarily in a way that we would consider an Irish food way. So influence to me is people. It's like, you know, Dickie Brennan. Or it can be someone like Pauline Patterson taking a comfort food for her and adding a Louisiana twist to it.
Of course, you know, as we search for those thin culinary threads
yes.
in New Orleans, there's one thing that it is not difficult to search for at all, because you can stumble across one in certainly every neighborhood, and that's the Irish bar.
Oh, pub, please.
Yes, okay.
Pub, please.
All
no.
right, okay.
There's a difference between a pub and a bar. You know, a pub is where you go when you want to share good news. A pub is where you go when you have really bad news and you want to just be with friends. It's, you know, an extension of your living room. And we have many of them here in the city, which is very good news for us. And I think that is a true Irish institute. And because the first place an Irish-born person today, 20 years ago, 50 years ago, whenever would have done when they arrived new in the city, is they would have found the first Irish pub. And then they would have announced who they were, find out if there's anybody from their part of Ireland, look for a place to stay, look for work. In other words, that was your port of entry, you know, the church and a pub. And today, the church doesn't play that role really to the same degree, but a pub does. And a pub is very important to, I think, the Irish psyche because, you know, over 100 million Irish people, you know, make up the diaspora. And with the economic downturn 2008, Ireland again began hemorrhaging people. And so when you're a stranger in a strange land, finding a comfortable, familiar place is very important. And that's what a pub does.
Take us on a little virtual pub crawl. please, Laura, just give us the highlights of some of your favorite Irish pubs and what makes one different from the next.
Okay, see, now you're going to make me choose, like, favorite children here, you know.
I know, that's not fair.
That's not fair.
Just off the top of your head, give us a little waltz around.
Well, if we weren't going to worry about distance, okay, we're not literally walking from one place to the other, although we could definitely sober up in between these places. Finn McCool's would be my starting point. And I would start with Finn's, and then you've got sort of the Holy Ground that's not very far away in mid-city. Matt Murphy's The Irish House is definitely worth, you know, relaxing your feet. It's beautiful interior and a really warm and inviting space. And he holds every Monday these music sessions, these Keelys. Mm-hmm. And so maybe we'll end up at Matt's and listen to some music. I would definitely go to the Carrie in the Quarter, without a doubt. The Aaron Rose. And as I'm working my way through the Quarter, I'd stop at Molly's, of course.
Of course you'd have to stop
at Molly's.
For a frozen Irish coffee.
And raise a toast to Jim Monahan.
What a guy.
And then, you know, we have Henry's. And looking into that and seeing that, four generations of, you know, one family pulling some draft beer and giving some whiskey to all of us. And whiskey, to me, is actually a great Irish food ways.
Good. I like that.
It is. And, you know, whiskey in Gaelic means the water of life. And that, I think, kind of says it all.
So how did St. Patrick's Day get to be such a big thing? So you find that, you know, barely 2 years after the Louisiana Purchase, they're having a St. Patrick's Day celebration of some sort. Well, when did it turn into the rollicking circus that it is today?
If you mean like parading, then we have the Ancient Order of Hibernians to thank for that. And they form after the Civil War. It's part of a national organization, but we get our Louisiana chapter in the 1870s, so during Reconstruction. And they are the ones who start the proper marching, proper parading, going down Canal Street. And they carry that through into the 20th century. And then the then tax assessor, Dickie Burke, and his brother, right after World War II in 1947, formed the Uptown Irish Channel St. Patrick's Day Parade Club. And they're the ones who said, you know, we got to move this just away from Canal. We've got this huge Irish community here. We need to have our own parade.
Well, I really am so thrilled that we were able to have this conversation
Me
with
too.
You at such a timely place in the year, that month that's all Irish, well, when it's not Italian, the month
yeah.
of March. Gosh, it's fun to live here, isn't
it? It is. I wouldn't live anywhere else. I wouldn't.
Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you. Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Laura D. Kelly, Adjunct Professor of History at Tulane University. To learn more, pick up a copy of Laura's book, The Irish in New Orleans, now in bookstores everywhere.
Back across the ocean to my home away from home. I'm glad to be returning, but sad to have to go. I'd like to find a way to be two places at one time. But it's easy going back again, but it's hard to say goodbye.
What was the cause of the Great Irish Potato Famine? We'll answer that question and explore that dire time when we come right back. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
The island that is silent now, but the ghosts still hunt the waves, and a torch lights up a famished man who fortune could not save.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What was the cause of the Great Irish Potato Famine? First, it's important to note that from the late 1700s on, the poor in Ireland subsisted entirely on one variety of potato. An average Irishman ate 14 pounds of boiled potatoes every day. But in September of 1845, when the annual potato harvest was about to begin, without warning, the leaves of the potato plants began to curl up, turn black, and rot. The plants actually began to ferment, creating a nauseating stench across the land. At first, when the farmers dug up the potatoes, they appeared to be fine, but within days, they too shriveled up and rotted. The culprit was an airborne fungus that quickly spread across Ireland in the cool, moist air. That first year, the poor Irish survived by selling their livestock and pawning off their meager belongings. But when the crop failed entirely for the second year, the Great Starvation set in. Irish in the countryside began to live off wild blackberries and ate nettles, turnips, old cabbage leaves, edible seaweed, roadside weeds, and even green grass. Tragically, the populace sickened and began to die. The lucky ones made it to America, the land of plenty, where today they're an important part of this country's cultural heritage. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
All you heard for years in Ireland was the wearing of the green. But the biggest change is coming island I have ever seen. All the laddies and the coolies laid aside their Irish reel. And I was born in Ireland, so imagine how I feel.
After Laura Kelly told me all about the history of Irish immigrants in New Orleans, I wanted to go straight to the source and talk with some modern-day Irish immigrants. But Pauline and Stephen Patterson are more than just immigrants. They're the owners of Finn McCool's, a traditional Irish pub that can satisfy anyone who's looking for a taste of the Emerald Isle. I sat down with Pauline and Stephen to find out what brought them together and then what brought them to New Orleans.
So take us back to the beginning. How did the two of you come together in the first place?
I worked at a store called Dunn's Stores, which is sort of like the equivalent of Target, I suppose. It's an Irish-owned clothing and grocery store. And we had our annual May ball at a local
nightclub
called the Corngrove. And Stephen was working at the nightclub, and I was there with all my friends and workers. And at the end of the night, when when after they've called last call,
yes,
all of the workers get a chance to fraternize with the guests. So he asked me up to dance.
We were allowed. We were always allowed 30 minutes before we had to finish our shift to go out and have one drink. And we were only 17 then, by the way, just so you know.
Both of y'all were just 17.
Yeah, we were 17.
That's so sweet.
And I'd been keeping an eye on Pauline during the night as I was working. And, you know, most nights we would get off and I'd ask a girl to dance and sometimes it would happen and sometimes it wouldn't. So we had 30 minutes, so I knew I had to make my move. So I asked Pauline to dance and luckily she said yes. And. Yeah. We just got stuck in.
He asked me what type of music I liked, and I said, "Oh, I really like Bette Midler." And he goes, "Yeah, my ma likes her too." So I said, "What type of music do you like?" And he goes, "I like Northern Soul." And I went, "Oh, I've never heard of them." And it's a genre of music.
Oh.
So after two insults, we still are together.
That's right.
And how many years has that been?
Since 1984.
30 years.
30 years. That's the luck of the Irish.
That's it.
How did you get a notion to come here?
I had read A Streetcar Named Desire and I'd wanted to see where it was set. And we came here, we worked in Wildwood, New Jersey for a couple of summers. And one summer we made a bit of extra money that we could afford to travel. And we came down to see where A Streetcar Named Desire was set. And we were only supposed to stay for 2 weeks, but we were only supposed to stay for a couple of days and then work our way back up the coast and then fly back to Ireland. And what we ended up doing was staying in New Orleans the entire 2 weeks, flying back home, finishing college and flying straight back out. We just fell in love with how friendly New Orleanians are and the food is amazing. And we were here during the summer, but that's when we visited, so it didn't deter us.
Well, if that doesn't deter you, nothing will. So how do you hatch the plan? So you come for the visit, you go back to Ireland. How do you make the arrangements, hatch the plan? How's that go?
Well, we grew up during the Troubles, so we were encouraged by both sets of our parents to leave Ireland as soon as we could, because there's always a chance that you could get caught up in it. And, you know, so basically, we were encouraged to leave. My mum and dad regret it now because they're at home. And it's sort of hard for us, you know, seeing them getting older. But they get to come and visit, which is brilliant.
Yeah, growing up in Ireland, I mean, we grew up in the 70s and 80s and there was a lot of political strife going on and there was high unemployment. So Pauline had an uncle in America and he was the first one to sort of invite us to come. You should come over to America and check it out. So that was a dream of ours. So once we did, we saw that there was money to be made. We saw that there was, you know, nobody mentioned politics or Irish politics anyway where we were. So that was sort of good. Everybody got along and we loved the, you know, the atmosphere and the freedom that America gave you. So when we tried New Orleans, like Pauline said, we only intended to stay for a couple of days and we ended up that first visit staying for the whole 2 weeks because it completely, every day when we were thinking about leaving, there was something else came up that we had to see and visit. So that was awesome. So once we went back to Ireland, our whole focus was just getting ready for our return to New Orleans and we knew that we wanted to come back here. So you basically work and save up for the whole year. Pauline was finishing university. I was working in the bars back there. And the moment Pauline finished her college, she didn't even stay for her graduation.
Yeah, I just made sure that I'd passed.
Whenever they told her she'd got her degree in art, we basically got on a plane, two rucksacks and as much, you know, cash as we could get, a couple hundred bucks each. Came to New Orleans.
Wow.
And lived in the French Quarter for the first couple of years. So didn't leave the French Quarter for probably the first 8 months we were there because everything was there that we needed. You know, our entertainment, the apartment, food, camaraderie. And it was just a great, you know, great first year in New Orleans. And that just cemented us. And then, you know, we got married here.
Yeah.
Then just started to build a life. And back then, you know, the French Quarter was really, you know, getting every year the tourism was getting better. Back then, the summertime, it was a wasteland in New Orleans. You know, it was very tough. There was no conventions coming. And the bartending. We weren't making a lot of money bartending back then. So we wanted to do something else. So we started buying houses, old houses, and fixing them up. And we didn't really have any experience in that.
But you had a hammer.
Yeah. So that was something we learned on the job, you know. And we, over the past, you know, 25 years, we've bought and renovated close to 30 different properties.
Well, Stephen, I'm so curious. You know, contractors work really hard. They kind of work dawn to dusk. But becoming a bar owner, now that's another whole bailiwick, you might say.
Yeah. Absolutely.
What possessed you?
We fell into it by accident.
Well, I was working, obviously we both worked in bars, but I was working at Mix, and a group of my regulars came in and they were having a great time. I was telling them jokes, pouring them drinks. And then after about the fourth drink, one of the men called me over and said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" And I said, "Yeah, go ahead." And he said, "What's a middle-aged woman like yourself still bartending for?"
Oh, that's
and
charming.
And I was 35. I went, "Are you joking me?" So I realised at some level, fellas have a longer shelf life as a bartender than women do, which is unfortunate. So after staring at myself in the mirror for about 2 weeks solid, going, "Why is he calling me middle-aged?" I decided to go into real estate. That was something that you could do sort of part-time and I could still keep the bartending job. So I became a real estate agent, Ballater and Bloom, and I was tasked to find one of my clients a bar. He specifically wanted to buy Mix, so I approached the owner of Mix and he went, "Never, I'm never selling, but I know another bar that's for sale, so why don't you approach that person?" So I brought my client to that bar, which is now Finn McCool's, and he said, "You couldn't pay me to buy this bar," which is a testament to what type of bar it was before we took it over. So after long discussion, myself and Stephen and another couple decided we would go in for it and buy it.
Yeah, well, whenever we opened the bar in July of 2002. And it was a struggle at the start because it was a
dicey neighborhood.
People that we knew from other bars. We were both working at bars then. I was working at O'Flaherty's in the French Quarter. And Pauline was working another bar in Mid-City. So, but they didn't want to travel to. They thought that was a different part of the city that they just didn't want to go to, below Canal Street.
Mm-hmm. Or below Carrollton.
And below Carrollton. Yeah. So it took a while. And it took, 3 years after that. So that's the summer of 2005. We had started to... We were trying to position ourselves as a New Orleans neighborhood bar with Irish and international niche sports. So we would get games in on the big satellite dish that no other bars would carry. And we would show them at 2 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, because of the time difference. They were coming from all over the world. And sometimes we only had 2 people, but sometimes we had 100 people. So you had to show them all to make sure that you would be able to catch those big games. And
because it was like buying a package deal.
So. Yeah, but that was just that was like an effort that we did, that we wanted to try and differentiate ourselves. We just didn't want to be another watering hole, if you know what I mean. We wanted to be a community-led pub that would be an extension of people's living rooms and where they would come to meet other people, come to get work, come to, if they needed to raise money, if they needed help, they would come to Finn McCool's to get help.
Networking.
Mm-hmm. It was the original networking place.
So tell me, what is St. Patrick's Day like in the day of the Pattersons?
Very, very long. We've done this the entire time that we've owned Finn's. We have the weeest parade in the world. Finn's is a long, narrow bar, but it has a front door and a side door that is probably only
40 feet.
40 feet at the most. We have a king and queen. We have St. Patrick and St. Bridget. We have a leprechaun. We have floats made out of cardboard that people step into. And we parade from the front door to the side door and it's over. You might, for everybody to do it, we'll have to do it several times, but we have a bagpiper that leads it and we have...
So it's the shortest, we're trying to get it recognised as the shortest Irish parade in the world. And we are also trying to get recognised as the lowest Irish pub in the world because we are below sea level officially in mid-city. And we know there's, you know, pubs in Peru or up the mountains and, you know, I think there's some in Europe that are up in the Pyrenees that are really high up. So we would like to get recognised as the lowest, unless there's somewhere that's, you know.
I can't imagine.
And there's a pub in the Dead Sea or something that's, or it, you know, 40 feet below sea level. I think we're officially 6 or 10 feet below sea level. So I think we're in the running anyway to be the lowest Irish pub in the world.
So basically, the day, St. Patrick's Day itself, it starts off really, really early and we do Irish breakfast sandwiches with Irish sausage, Irish bacon, black and white pudding, fried egg, cheese. And we used to serve it on a plate, but not everything got eaten. So we now what we've done is put it into a big crusty bap and you can have HP sauce with it. So you, at least you line your stomach first thing in the morning. And then we have what we call the Irish Olympics throughout the day. It's cabbage bowling and cabbage and carrot and onion juggling and Guinness flip cup. And we're going to have 50 Shades of Green fundraiser for St. Baldrick's Day. And then we actually... It's run from January all the way through to the second week of March. We run a writing contest. There's 10 words that you're supposed to use in the contest and in the story. And Ian McNulty and Stevie Ray judge that. And
so it's a short story contest. And we started it off the first year as just a bit of a laugh, but we got a lot of people. You know, we saw how creative our customers were and it has grown over the years. And we publish the stories every year in a book.
Well, it makes perfect
sense.
It's
a lot of fun, yeah.
Shortest parade, yeah. Short stories. I'm
we're
surprised.
The land of saints and scholars, you say.
I'm surprised you're such a tall man.
True. Yeah. Well, hopefully my head will be above sea level for most of it.
And then we put out free food on at 3 o'clock. On St. Patrick's Day, and it's Irish stew and shepherd's pie, and we obviously do the Irish American corned beef and cabbage.
Who does the cooking, Pauline?
I do.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to have a lot of help from the kitchen this year, though, so that's awesome. And then we actually have Chef Emil Stifel. I don't know if you know him. He beat Bobby Flay in the jambalaya cook-off.
Oh, he can join the club.
He's actually cooking the biggest pot of corned beef and cabbage. Like it's something like 80-gallon pot.
Oh
and he's
gosh.
Going to be cooking it that day on location.
At Finn McCool's.
Oh, that's so fun.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds like really a good time. Yeah. I can't wait for St. Patrick's Day. Yeah. I'll be there.
Yes. Fantastic.
I have to make sure it doesn't rain.
Well, I really want to thank you guys so much for spending this time with me and telling me your really inspiring stories. You know, America could use more immigrants.
I agree.
Yeah.
Thank you, Poppy.
I'm glad you all are New Orleanians. Thank you.
Thank you. It was brilliant. Thank you.
Pauline and Stephen Patterson of Finn McCool's Bar. By now, you must be ready to tuck into some corned beef and cabbage. But did you know that corned beef and cabbage is not really an authentic Irish dish? Actually, it's distinctly Irish-American. Back in the old country, bacon was cabbage's culinary companion. So how does corned beef enter into the picture? Irish immigrants of the late 19th century discovered the salty spiced beef in New York's Jewish delis. Much like Irish bacon, it was inexpensive. And when cooked in the same pot with cabbage, it was easy as pie to prepare. Speaking of pie, shepherd's pie is a true dish of the Emerald Isles, where the meat used is usually lamb. Thus the shepherd reference. This dish, often made with leftover meat and mashed potatoes, was originally called cottage pie, named for the simple housing where the impoverished Irish farmers lived. Real shepherd's pie doesn't have a pastry crust. Instead, a layer of mashed potatoes forms the base and the topping for the savory filling. Here's how to make a simply magical shepherd's pie. If you have some leftover roasted lamb, beef, turkey, or chicken, just coarsely chop the meat and combine it with the leftover gravy. No leftover roast? No problem. Just brown some ground beef or lamb along with a chopped onion. Add a touch of red wine, some herbs, a tablespoon of tomato paste or ketchup, and season with salt and pepper. Grease a baking pan well before spooning in the bed of mashed potatoes. Top the potatoes with the meat mixture, then more potatoes, and bake the pie until it's lightly browned. If you're a cheese lover like me, you might want to include a layer of shredded cheddar between the meat and potatoes and add a little additional sprinkling of cheese on top. You'll find a copy of this recipe on our website at itsneworleans.com and at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Food writer Scott Gold got a crash course in Irish cuisine when he first visited the Emerald Isle 10 years ago. Here, Scott proclaims his love for the calorific and over-the-top Irish breakfast.
When I first visited Ireland a number of years ago for a wedding, I didn't really know what to expect when it came to the cuisine. Given my limited exposure to Irish food, my first thought, of course, was potatoes and corned beef and cabbage, the usual stereotypes. As it turned out, the cuisine of the Emerald Isle has way more in common with my Louisiana home than I had imagined. First of all, there were oysters. Great ones, too. The city of Galway, one of my favorite places on the face of the planet, is actually renowned for their bivalves, and they even host one of the biggest oyster festivals in the world. Add to that the fact that Galway is a city on the water, and that it also has a rich music and drinking culture, and it's hard not to call the place the New Orleans of Ireland. But there was one aspect of food in Ireland that I hadn't given much consideration. Breakfast. On my first morning in the town of Sligo, where the wedding would be held, I encountered for the first time the unabashed, shamelessly brazen nature of breakfast in Ireland. The owner of the bed and breakfast in which we were staying also doubled as its cook. He asked me that morning what I'd like to eat, and I deferred to him, seeing as I didn't know what my options were, and I assumed he would know better than I. "How about a full Irish?" he asked. I paused to consider this, for a couple of reasons. First, offering to give someone a full Irish can sound slightly dirty if your brain is inclined in that direction, which of course mine is. Second, I had no idea what it meant. Would he roast a sheep in the yard for me? Would there be Guinness? Or maybe even whiskey? Singing? Fighting? Again, I deferred to the Irish inn owner and just went with it. Not long after, our friendly B&B proprietor set before me a plate filled with the kind of food that you might desire if you were, say, scaling the cliffs of Moher that day, or maybe going into battle against hordes of bloodthirsty Viking invaders. There was bacon, thick rashers more like ham than the crispy bacon we're accustomed to in the States, as well as sausage links, black pudding, which is blood sausage, white pudding, a sausage more like boudin, two sunny-side-up eggs, and thick slices of rustic toasted black bread. There was, essentially, enough meat and cholesterol on this plate to choke a manatee, and the only thing even hinting at a fruit or vegetable was a single stewed tomato, which seemed to me like an afterthought, if a tasty one. As for condiments, I was offered only one. "Would you care for some brown sauce?" the man asked me. Again, my ignorance reared its head. "What is brown sauce?" I inquired. "Well," he replied, thinking of an appropriate description, "it's a sauce, right? And it's brown. Brown sauce." I said, okay. Suffice it to say, I fell immediately and irrevocably in love with the full Irish. I had that same plate of food in the same inn for 3 consecutive days, adoring every bite of it until, on the 4th day, I felt myself sweating pork fat and breathing a little more heavily than usual, at which time I switched to cereal. Much as I love Ireland, if I was going to die a food-related death, I would prefer to do it on my own turf. I've always sought out the full Irish in whatever city I've lived, as a means of comfort and also a way to balance the very important blood sausage content level we've learned to be so important to living a happy life. Fortunately, I've found it here in my hometown of New Orleans, at the Irish House on St. Charles Avenue, at the hands of Chef Matt Murphy. I can't say that I have the fortitude to down that magnificent bounty of meat and eggs every day, or even every week. But when I do it with aplomb, and it always makes me think fondly and happily of my time in Ireland, and of that cheery inn owner and his wife, of rolling green hills, of sheep, and the feel of a soft Erin sweater. This St. Patrick's Day, or perhaps the day after, I urge you to avail yourself of a full Irish. I know I will, and probably with a pint of Guinness for good measure, and of course, for strength. I'll wish you cheers as I do so, or as the Irish say, sláinte.
That was food writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. His Food Porn Fridays column can be found each week at nolavie.com. My chat with the Pattersons of Finn McCool's gave me a window into what it's like for young Irish immigrants to come to New Orleans and build a classic Irish pub from the ground up. While it's impressive to start a pub from scratch, it's just as impressive to run a pub that's been in your family for generations. I sat down with Nell Boyle, owner of Henry's Uptown Bar, whose family has cared for their heirloom for four generations. Nell, four generations, that is really auspicious. Take us back to what you all believe to be the beginning of Henry's.
Okay, well, I just have some written information that a relative of my mother's had written to her because she did some research. The original owner was Frank Varden, and he was a resident of Galway in Ireland. The story goes that his mother died when he was very young, and his father remarried. And his stepmother was not very nice to him. The way he used to say it, according to the history that I have, is that she was very mean. So at the age of 12, he left home and lived with some Irish gypsies for 3 or 4 years.
Now, that's a wild story.
It is wild. That's the way he told it. And then one of his father's friends from his village happened to see him, and he told him, "Frank, I'm going to tell your dad that I saw you." And he did not want to go home. So he found a ship that was sailing and just got on a ship, landed in Canada. So then he worked on barges bringing ice down from Canada to New Orleans. And that's how he came about, living in New Orleans.
So, Nell, what time period are we talking about?
When he got to New Orleans, we believe it was around 1885.
Gosh. And so what else do you know about his early days in New Orleans?
Well, he befriended James Lee. And James Lee was my great-grandfather. James Lee invited him to the family's house for supper, and he met James' sister, Catherine, and they married.
Oh, that's very charming. How many children did they have?
They had four children, three girls and one boy.
So what's he doing at this time for a living?
Well, from what we know and understand, he started the bar. Then,
And was it in the same location that it is today?
Yes, the same location. All four of his children were born there.
In the bar?
Well,
they lived in
merchants,
the bag.
Right. All the merchants on Magazine Street had residents living quarters behind their businesses. And so that was the case there. What happened, at some point, he turned the bar over to Catherine's brother, his brother-in-law, which was my great-grandfather, James Lee. And so then James had it after that, and I'm not sure what year that was, sometime around the 1900s or late 1800s. Then James Lee and his wife Margaret Tully, and she was from Cork, Ireland. Their child was born there also. They moved into the residence quarters, and their daughter was born there.
And they only had one daughter?
One daughter, and that was my mother's mother, my grandmother.
So they have a daughter.
One daughter.
Well, surely she's not going to run the bar,
no,
is she?
No, right. Their daughter was Mary Ellen, and she married Edward Crone. And when her father passed away, Edward Crone, who would be my grandfather, took it over from him. So
Now we're like in the 30s or the 40s?
No, earlier than that.
Earlier than that.
Yeah,
wow.
I would think, yeah, like the 20s. And actually during Prohibition too, you know.
So your grandfather, and then he has, who's the next generation?
Okay, then they have Dorothy, who is my mother, and Edward, her brother. And unfortunately, her brother was in World War II at Guadalcanal, and he broke his neck.
Oh.
His neck was broken during the war. So
he lived?
He was paralyzed, yes, from the neck down. He really couldn't do much of anything. Back then, there wasn't a whole lot of rehab for people like him, you know, unfortunately. But anyway, my mother and father were going to be married in December, and then her dad unexpectedly passed away a couple of months before that.
Oh, gosh, it must have just been such a terrible, turbulent time in your family.
True, very true.
You know, and your mother's not even married yet.
No, and her mother died when she was 5. So she had a lot of trials and tribulations in her life, but she always remained happy and, you know, just... she's my inspiration. She really is. When my mother's father passed away, my dad came in. Well, he was sick for a short period of time, so my dad came in to help him because they were engaged at the time.
Uh-huh.
And then he died, and my dad just kept running it. He took it over in 1946 until... probably 2008.
And along comes his family, which consists of you and your brother.
And there was another brother, but he passed away. So there were three of us. My other brother that passed away was Henry. And then the younger brother is Stephen.
So what happened when your dad dies? Who takes over? At what point does your generation step into this picture?
Well, we actually stepped in after Hurricane Katrina.
Well, it was after Katrina that Henry's became such a sort of a young people.
Yes.
Bar. That's so
yes.
Interesting. What do you think caused that?
I know exactly what it was. There was a young man and he taught at Loyola. He's a history professor at Loyola, and he lived around the corner. And he used to love to come in and talk to my dad and my dad's brothers lots of times. In the later years, there wasn't a whole lot of business. It was mostly the older neighborhood guys. My dad's brothers would be there a lot, and they would just all sit around and talk.
Uh-huh.
And Mike Ross was the history professor at Loyola. And he loved to go in there and talk to the older guys and, you know, talk about the war and whatever. After Katrina, he told everybody, his friends, how great this place was. And before you know it, we had a bunch of Loyola teachers and Tulane teachers coming in the bar, you know. And
that's wonderful.
And then it just kind of took off from there.
Nell Boyle of Henry's Bar.
When I was a young man, I carried me pack, and I lived the free life of the rover. From the Murray's green basin to the dusty outback.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we take a tour of the Domino Sugar Refinery.
These two big cranes that you see here can discharge raw sugar at the rate of about 1 million pounds an hour.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by Bacardi USA and Dickey Brennan and Company. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to our producer, Chris Kehoe, associate producers, Joe Schreiner and Sarah Holtz. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.